All righty. Well, for class from now on until I'm not sure when, time will tell, we're going to take a look at the book of Exodus. And we, a few weeks ago or a little time ago, we looked at the opening a little bit. And I just thought we would take a little review of that today and kind of get us going here. And before we do that, I make a couple comments, things that we can do as we go through Exodus. And Kirk really touched on one quite a bit today. The idea of something in the Old Covenant or the nation of Israel or something in the Old Testament referring to or looking ahead to something that's going to come into the New Covenant. So I want us to, I want us to look for those things as we go through the book of Exodus here. And I think we're going to see quite a bit of things. I don't think that's how you should say that. Several things that that we're going to see that this looking forward to the future or the new covenant, and God really had a purpose for everything that He did, even the little details that seem very unique to the physical nation of Israel. There was a purpose for them, and I think it'll be good for us to see that and to see some of the intentions that God had with those things. Second comment, I guess, the book of Exodus is, you know, a lot of history is what, you know, what we see here with the nation of Israel and how they, you know, exit the nation or their captivity from Egypt. That's kind of the title of the book there, Exodus. It means to exit or to go out of. So we're going to see that and kind of see the story unfold. Moses, different generations and whatnot. So I think hopefully it'll be interesting and it'll be good for us to look at. And when I started this a little while ago, the first thing I looked at or the kind of question is, you know, how did they end up there? Why did these people end up in Egypt? Did Egypt come and conquer them and take them back as captives? And that's not the case. Is we kind of touched on some things. We kind of went reversed a little bit before we move forward with why. And we're not going to go back through all these scriptures today. It's quite a bit of reading, but I just thought we'd just kind of highlight it. And we know that these people came to Egypt with Jacob. And then we asked, well, why did Jacob come? And Jacob found out that his son Joseph was there and alive and well. And in his old age, he wanted to go see him. And then we were wondering, well, why did Joseph get there? And then we saw where Joseph was sold to the traders, and he was taken into Egypt. And then we saw where Joseph really prospered when he was there and really put into high authority by the Pharaoh at that time. And we saw that, you know, how the hatred that his brothers had towards him that motivated them to get rid of him. So in a roundabout way, this hatred that they had for their brother ended up being something that saved them down the road. We'll see where Joseph, you know, has grace on them later on. And then we started to see all the movement that Jacob did within his life prior to going to Egypt. We went back to the stolen blessing, and then Jacob was sent away, and then God's promise was extended. That promise to Abraham was extended through Jacob. And we see where Jacob meets Rachel, and then where he is deceived, and then we see where the birth of Joseph when he was born. And then we see again where another circumstance where Jacob's on the move and leaving and moves out and stuff. And then we know that he went to stay with Laban and went through the story there a little bit, how they ended up parting ways. It's kind of the separation and the covenant they had between them. And then we see when Jacob leaves there, he still continues to have this fear of his brother Esau from something that happened years and years ago. He's afraid to go home because his brother's there, and he thinks he's probably going to kill him if he goes there. And then we saw where Jacob and Esau, they meet, and the greetings and stuff that they had there, and the interaction. And then we see where Jacob continues to go back home. And then again, we saw some more trouble brought to Jacob through his family, and eventually that caused him to move again and arrives in Ephrath. So from that point there, then we know of the famine that comes. They had no food, and word gets around that they could go to Egypt and get food. So Joseph's brothers are sent there by Jacob to go and to get food. And we know the story where they go, and then they come back, and they make a couple trips there, and then they end up, Joseph ends up disclosing to them who he is, and gets the rest is history, I guess you could say. But at the beginning part of this chapter, we talked about the beginning part of Exodus chapter 1. We talked about Joseph being there with his family, and verse 5 of Exodus 1, it says, "All the persons who came from the loins of Jacob were 70 in number, but Joseph was already in Egypt. And Joseph died, and all his brothers and all that generation." We talked about that some, talking about the time span that probably was covered there within these generations. And it's kind of the end of the era of Joseph, I guess you could say, at that point a little bit. And one thing I wanted to highlight again was in verse 5 that there were the people who came with Jacob were 70 in number. So 70 people, not that big of a crowd, especially when you're talking nationwide. Not a noticeable bunch of people by any means. And when they came, they were given kind of pretty special treatment, really, because Joseph was highly looked upon by the leaders there, by Pharaoh. So his family, when they came, they were treated quite well. It's not that they were just allowed to be there and survive, and to he didn't just, more than that, he kind of give them the best of the best type of situation. So really, at that point, these people had it about as good as you could have it, as far as you look at it worldwide. I mean, Egypt was a place where they could live, they could eat. They were able to survive. And then we see where there's kind of gets to be this transition a little bit, the attitude, maybe you could say, towards these people. And I guess before that, we see in verse 7 where they continued to grow. They were fruitful and increased greatly and multiplied and became exceedingly mighty, so that the land was filled with them. So from these 70, all of a sudden they were all over the place. These people that came were very mighty. And then we go on in verse 8. It says, "Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, 'Behold, the people of the sons of Israel are more and mightier than we.'" So this new king, this again leads me back to the point where some time has passed here. Because if it was a new king that, knew Joseph, maybe was a little younger, knew the story of Joseph, he probably would have extended his grace maybe towards Joseph. But he didn't know who Joseph was. All he knew at this point was there's all these people around here that don't belong to the nation of Egypt. And he was concerned about it. And his attitude towards Joseph's family, or towards these people, the Israelites, began to change quite quickly. There it comes. So that kind of leads us up to where we're at today, I guess. But gives us a little bit of a very quick background of how these people ended up there and really became, and we're going to see how they become enslaved and kind of in captivity. I began to talk about this, I guess, about Pharaoh's fear of these people. Exodus chapter 1, verse 10, he says, "Come, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply in the event of war. They also join themselves to those who hate us and fight against us and depart from the land." So he was worried about his enemies, and he was thinking, you know, if we get into a battle or kind of get into a war, if these people would turn against us, they'd probably overpower us, because they were throughout the entire land. They were embedded within this country, within the borders everywhere. You know, geologically, they could have rose up and attacked the Egyptians from anywhere, from all different positions. And that concerned Pharaoh quite a bit. And we see with that same thought, kind of a conflicting thought a little bit. At the end of that verse, so he was afraid that they would join themselves against the enemy and fight against them, but at the same time, he was worried that they were going to depart from the land. So if he was just worried about them being there, you would think that any event there was that would trigger them to leave, well, that would make him happy, wouldn't it? Because then all these people would be gone and he wouldn't have to worry about them. But that's not really the case there. He was worried about them joining the enemies, but at the same time, he didn't want them to leave. So that's interesting. Obviously, he's got something. He's thinking about something, you can tell. He's got the gears. Gears are turning there. So what does he do? We see in the next few verses here. If somebody would like to read Exodus 1, verses 11 through 14. We can just do some random reading today.
So they appointed taskmasters over them to afflict them with hard labor, and they built Pharaoh's storage cities, Pithom and Ramesses. The more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. The Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor.
Okay, so we see here that he thought, well, if they're going to be here, we better figure out a way to control these people. And what better way to control them is to make them slaves. And my first thought is, well, if there's all these people around there, why did they get behind this idea of becoming slaves? I think it's an example that they probably had them brainwashed a little bit before they knew what happened, and then all of a sudden they were under control of the Egyptians. But they built amazing things. I mean, we know just through history today, I mean, the pyramids are still there. You know, some of the great architectural things that these slaves did, and not only did they build things, they worked in the fields, they probably were doing all the farming and providing the food for the whole nation, and they did a lot of things. There's a lot of people there that were under control of these Egyptians, and they built some wonderful things for them. So probably at this point, Pharaoh was thinking, well, this idea is working pretty good. You know, we got all these people here. Now we're putting them to work, and they're doing all this stuff for us. And so maybe he wasn't quite as worried about them being there, because now he kind of had them under control. It was about the control that he had. One thing that I think is important for us to look at here is in verse 12, it says, but the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out. So they were in dread of the sons of Israel. And I just couldn't help but think, my mind went ahead to in Acts chapter 8. Now this is right after during the persecution of the church. And we see here, we talked about this story as well, when Paul was strongly in opposition of the church. And not only did he go out and persecute others, but he supported the people that were persecuting the church as well. And we see where this is right after, excuse me, I get the right chapter here, the right book. This is right after the events when Stephen was put to death. And if we just look at Acts chapter 2, or chapter 8, verse 2. And on that day, a great persecution rose against the church in Jerusalem, And they were all scattered throughout the regions of Judea and Samaria except the apostles. So, we have the nation of Egypt that the harder they oppress these people and persecute them, well, they spread out more. They're trying to get away from this control and this persecution. So in effect, this negative impact that Pharaoh has upon them, what it's really doing is just spreading them out more, and there's becoming more of them. And we see the same thing happen with the church in Jerusalem there. So there's this great persecution in Jerusalem. So, you know, what did the church do? Did they just close the doors and, well, this isn't worth it? No. They spread out. They thought, well, let's get away from here. So all of a sudden, the church gets bigger and bigger. And I think that's something we can see throughout history a lot. And it's a good example there in Exodus that, you know, putting the pressure on somebody and, you know, Pharaoh really having his thumb on these people, in a sense, it might seem like to him that it was working for him. But in the long run, all it was doing was making more of these people and spreading them out deeper and probably throughout all of his country where, in a sense, he was losing more control all the time. So, and when I use that comparison from the church, it's kind of the same sense that Satan is putting pressure against the church, trying to squash it. But in a sense, all he's really doing is he's spreading it out to different people, different regions. And I just that comparison just really popped into my mind when I read that verse in Exodus there about the Israelites spreading out. Anybody got any comments there before we kind of get to the next section here? No? What's that?
That was verse 1.
Verse 1. Was it?
Yeah.
Did I say 2?
Yeah. No worries.
You know, these things, I need a proofreader maybe to look at all this stuff where I put it out. Yeah, it was first. Yeah. It was the second part of the verse. So, you know, that helps, right? Okay, I'll get back to Exodus here now. So Exodus, he has this, Pharaoh has this plan that, well, we're going to put these people in under slavery. They're going to build these great things for us. We're going to control them. We're going to have them right where we want them. But pretty short-term plan. In verse 14, it said, and they made their lives bitter with hard labor and mortar and bricks and all kinds of labor in the field, and their labors which were rigorously imposed on them. So, I mean, very hard on these people. And it seemed like the harder they were on them, the more they multiplied, the more they spread out. Just, man, he can't win here, can he? So let's go to plan B. Well, if we can't control them, we better limit them, right? So he has this great plan. Exodus 1. Would somebody like to read verses 15 and 16? Exodus 1, 15 and 16. Okay, so here's this plan. Put this plan into act. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to eliminate the young males. And you just think about this as far as controlling the population of any kind of group, whether it's people or animals or whatnot. The best way to do that is to eliminate the young males, right? Just when you think about cattle, if you don't want them to breed. And to keep increasing, you know, you turn the bulls into steers, right? So you in a sense, you eliminate that portion of the gene pool. So he thought, well, we'll just get rid of the boys, and after some time goes by, they're not going to be able to keep having babies. They're going to slow down, right? We're not going to have as many people. So he tells the midwives, when these Hebrew women are given birth, if you see it's a boy, you kill him. But if it's a little girl, then you let him live. Pretty cruel, right? Pretty crude way to handle people. And I think this example here, Pharaoh really misses an early sign that God gives him to show him who really is in power. Because when Pharaoh commands these midwives to do this, and we have to understand when these kings of this era, they live and die by very strict rule. If you disobey what they say, they're going to kill you. There's no negotiating with these people. They're very strict dictators. But we see that... here, let me just click here. Oh, I should have backed up there. Let's. Would somebody like to read 17 through 21? I'm sorry, 17 through 21. Okay, so we see this, the commandment to the midwives. So at that point, you could say that they had to make a choice, that the midwives did. What were they going to do? And we hear the term a lot that they, you know, well, it was the lesser of the two evils. Or do you follow the rulers of the country to the point where you're going to disobey God to follow them? You know, who truly is your king, I guess, is the question. But we see where these, and they know that, they had to know that at some point, Pharaoh's going to catch on to them, think, well, all these little boys are running around. Obviously, these midwives didn't do what I told them to do. It's going to be pretty obvious. So they know that at some point, they're going to have to answer to him. But they chose to do what was right. And they told him, and... This could be a lot of truth in this statement in verse 19, but is it 100% truth? Did every single Hebrew woman that gave birth, was she able to have her child and hide it and stuff before the midwife was aware that it was a boy? No, I don't think so. But this is the answer that they gave to Pharaoh. They said, because of the Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and they give birth before the midwife can get to them. And maybe there's some truth there. Maybe that happened quite a bit. But that's what they chose to use to defend, you know, why they weren't able to do what Pharaoh said. And God obviously, you know, through Pharaoh, he protected them. Because Pharaoh, as we see, he chose not to strike them down. But in verse 21, and it came about because the midwives feared God that he established households for them. So they were rewarded for not following Pharaoh, but by following God. So God, he was good to them for making the right choice. Go ahead, Kirk. Probably. And that's a good point. I don't think it was an outright lie, you know, to Pharaoh's face when they told him that. Yeah. I think, and I'm sure that not very much time went by and the word kind of spread too. They're like, hey, you guys can't let these midwives get to you. Right. You know, because, you know, you might lose your baby. So it might have, you know, spurned them on a little bit with their birth. They might have, you know, been a little more secretive or, you know, made sure they didn't waste extra time or whatnot. But however they went about doing it, you know, these midwives, they did the right thing by sparing these babies, however they did it. So we see that that plan didn't work, apparently, because they didn't do what Pharaoh said. So what is it? We move on to plan C. So it didn't work to enslave them. That kept them going. It didn't do any good to try to kill the little boys when they were born, or, you know, the midwives to kill them. So we see in Exodus 1, verse 22, if somebody would like to read. Okay, so we see the next step here. Now we notice in plan B, as I call it, Pharaoh tried to work through the midwives because he knew those, they were the ones that were going to be there at birth and kind of help out, and maybe, you know, were right at the very beginning and had the opportunity to kill him. What we see now in plan C, as I say, is he told all the people. So everybody knew that these little baby boys are supposed to get killed, so probably there was more people that were on the lookout for it, possibly, and chuck them in the river and let them drown. That was his answer. That's how we control the population. Pretty harsh world that they lived in, wasn't it? All because he was worried about this group of people maybe gaining some power or a foothold in his country, and he was willing to sacrifice their life at all costs, apparently. I mean, you can see he had no consideration for the children. But what this plan does, again, it backfires, and I'm not going to get into that too much today. We're going to look at it more next week. Is that not only does it keep the nation of Israel going, but it places one of them in Pharaoh's own household. And we see that through Moses when he was a baby. And it's interesting for me to see how every time Pharaoh tries to do something against the nation of Israel, in a roundabout way, it helps them. And you can't help but think that God had, you know, obviously things were in motion long before you know, Moses was grown. He comes to Pharaoh and says, "Let my people go." You know, God was working his plan out from the, you know, from the beginning of this nation here. And it's clear that obviously, you know, that's God's intention with us too, right? He had a plan long before we were born, long before our generation. And you just look at Pharaoh and the Egyptians as an example, and we see the plans. You can see in chapter 3 here where he had three different plans to try to oppress these people, and it doesn't seem to be working. So whose plan do we think is going to work? Is it going to be God's plan, or is it going to be the leaders of this world, or this kingdom, or wherever it might be? And I don't think you can find a place in biblical or any history where the leaders of this world really were able to have long-term success. And long-term, I mean eternal. And so I think that's something we can really take from this book as we go through Exodus. We're going to see that whoever works against Israel in a roundabout way is helping them. And it's kind of the same way with the church. And it might seem like it's a little bit of a stretch, but in a lot of ways, especially early on in the church, it was one of the biggest motivating factors there was to spread the gospel. Because it wasn't safe to spread it here, so we're going to go spread it here. Same with Israel. Well, it wasn't safe to live right here, well, we'll go live here. And then we'll go live here, and before long, it's everywhere. And that was God's intention with the gospel. I think that's why the persecution was there, and that's why it was allowed. It was able to test people and to show them the strength that God was able to give them. So, anybody got any comments there? We'll kind of quit with that today a little bit.
People, that's fine, but when the wrong guy gets in there,
occur to them that down the road they could be taking over, you know, or something. They probably, I don't know if they didn't buy anything, they needed any weapons or however, you know, how did they come into the houses and drag out the male and go kill the male sons, you know, and stuff like that. And I guess the other question is, I mean, we're not told how it
right.
is, you know, there's something that they were oppressed by that the men didn't allow to happen. And then the other thing is how come it didn't continue to happen? How come they didn't continue to kill the male children? You know, I mean, they did it for a time period, but maybe they said, okay, we'll be your slaves if you don't do this or something.
Right.
You know, I mean, it was something that I mean, obviously it's kind of written into it for something, but obviously they let them live after a while.
I think that's kind of right on though, because they had control over them obviously somehow, and I'm sure that the people, especially when it comes to their children, they were kind of willing to do whatever they could do to save those babies, right?
Yeah.
And if, you know, being slaves or saying, hey, you know, we'll obey, we'll do what you want us to do if you quit killing these, you know, so it was probably a pretty effective method of oppressing them, I would think. And the idea of the famine too is because I mean the government was in charge of handing out all the food, right? So maybe it was like, well, you either listen to us or you're going to go hungry. And after a while, you get pretty hungry, so you start to do some drastic things. And I mean, like I said, it's looking into a little bit, but I think it's probably pretty realistic of what, you know, how that could happen. But
okay.
Go ahead, Kyle.
They
do. Yeah.
And, you know, we'll find out later when we get to Exodus, after they leave, they're like, well, we want to go back. You know,
right.
Sure they had food and things like that. But the other thing that, and this is maybe region, this comment, but because I don't know for sure, but there was somewhere around 2 million Jews that left Egypt when they left. And according to my just kind of quick calculations, we know that the promise of the law came 430 years later, right, after Abraham. And there was three generations prior to them coming to Egypt. So that's probably somewhere around 250 to 300 years from when there was the 70 people that came to Egypt to the time that they left. So I figured that up, and that's, of those 70 people, either way you do it, if it is just men, then you take that 70 families. Of those 70 families, they would, over the generations of, that's probably about 10 generations, there'd be about 50,000 descendants per family at that time over those 10 generations. So those people have a lot of single kids.
They were.
So I don't know.
I think there's a lot of that. A lot of that was going on probably at that point, because I mean, the number of people, you just can't help but think, well, if there are so many of them, why did they do that? But I don't think it wasn't a deal where all of a sudden one day they were free and the next day Pharaoh came and said, boom, we're going to do this. You know, they could have rose up against him, but took a little bits at a time here and there, and all of a sudden these people were kind of being oppressed before they even knew it, and then it was too late at that point. So their means of survival completely probably depended on the Egyptians, and at some point they probably had no means to overpower them, I guess. So it's a good lesson, a good warning in itself there.
Can I make one more?
You can. Yeah.
But at the same time, they didn't have to be, and they don't have to be.
That's right. And the biggest thing that it took to trigger that, to change their minds, was that awareness. That all of a sudden they started thinking, well, hey, this doesn't necessarily have to be this way, maybe. You know, this Moses guy that's telling us these things, maybe this is going to work. So, and spiritually, I think it's kind of the same way. I think it takes something to motivate people or to trigger people to start thinking differently, and they start seeing things a lot differently, and then that allows that change, allows that positive direction in their life, I think. So, go ahead, Kirk. Oh, sorry. Go ahead, Ken. You had, go ahead.
Well, back then, God was in control of things that went on with different governments and whatnot. So, he was one step ahead of them. And that was then, and we're 2,000 years later. He still has control. So, I think that's what we have faith in this day today.
That's right, yeah.
That's still controls over the government. He can control over the government, so I think
that's a good point, Ken. I like that idea. You know, he's one step ahead of them, just like he was with Pharaoh. It's no different now. I mean, he's not watching to see what the government does and then decide what he's going to do. You know, he's already on to the next step, next stage all the time. So that's right, yeah. Go ahead, Kirk.
I thought it's kind of interesting thinking about it. First off, the Hebrew midwives is what they were, and so it's interesting that, I mean, they didn't just sell out their fellow Hebrews just because Pharaoh commanded them for one. But it's also something, why did it mention specifically that the Hebrew midwives feared God? Because, you know, does that mean that there might have been a lot of Hebrews that didn't? I mean, I don't know. Why? I mean, I understand if there would have been like Egyptian midwives, and well, they feared God and they didn't listen. But why did he specify that the Hebrew midwives feared God? Because they should have feared God.
Right.
And so, you know, I don't know if that's any significant. There's a lot of some information, obviously, that's not there, maybe. Or maybe it's just referencing that they feared God, and that's why they didn't obey the king. And you can even go on that route, what you were saying before. They feared God. That's why they didn't obey the king, where people are saying you gotta obey the rules of the world in order to be a Christian.
Right.
You know, but I don't know if that's some of the reason why that's written that way.
Could be. There's I don't think it's coincidental, I guess. There's definitely a purpose there.
And probably multiple purposes.
I think. Yeah. For sure. So
it's probably more just they feared God rather than Pharaoh. More than
Pharaoh. Yeah.
All right. we'll kind of close there today, I guess. Let's pray together as we finish. Dear Heavenly Father, we're thankful for the opportunity to be together today and to look into your word, and we're just thankful for the history that you can teach us and helps us to see how things were working and what your purpose was, and just helps us to see that you really have been in control throughout all of eternity. We're just thankful for that. We're just thankful that we live under this, the new covenant, and we're just thankful for the sacrifice that Jesus made, and we know that he conquered that death and is reigning in heaven today, and we're just thankful, and we gain our hope from that, Lord, and we're just glad that we can do that, and we just pray now in Jesus' name. Amen.